Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Azerbaijan announces ceasefire in fight with Armenia. Azerbaijan announced a unilateral ceasefire today in the separatist region of Nagorno-Karabakh after clashes with Armenian forces left 30 soldiers dead Saturday and both sides reporting more fighting overnight. The outbreak of violence is the worst in Nagorno-Karabakh since 1994, when Armenia and Azerbaijan ended a war over the territory that is part of Azerbaijan but has been under control of Armenian forces. The two sides are separated by a demilitarized buffer zone, but each side accuses the other of numerous violations. The opposition in Cameroon has defied police and continued protests against efforts by the ruling party to organize early elections. The opposition says Cameroon's 84-year-old president, Paul Biya, is angling to be president for life after 34 years already in office. Kawala, opposition leader of the Cameroon People's Party, says dozens of protesters have been arrested or wounded by heavily armed police in several towns.
The police, as you see, they have blocked us. They have shoved us. They will not allow us to talk. They will not allow us to do our job as the political leaders of this country. They have stepped on the rights of citizens.
A Cameroon government spokesperson says the protests are illegal. The first passenger flight has taken off from the airport in Brussels, where suicide bombers carried out a deadly attack nearly 2 weeks ago. The blast there and at a nearby metro station killed 32 people and destroyed the airport's departure area. Brussels Airlines plane heading to the Portuguese city of Faro was the first of three flights scheduled to leave the airport. This is VOA News. Hours before the scheduled start of the deportation of hundreds of migrants from the island of Lesbos, Greek officials had yet to finalize their plans under a deal between the European Union and Turkey. Activists in Lesbos planned a protest for Monday when Greek authorities, with the help of hundreds of border police officers from EU countries, were to escort migrants from a migration detention camp to a port where ferries were to take them back to Turkey. Meantime, the International Organization for Migration reports a large number of sub-Saharan Africans, mainly from Nigeria, Mali, Gambia, and Senegal, have been arriving in Italy this year. Lisa Schlein reports.
The International Organization for Migration reports at least 170,000 refugees and migrants have crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Turkey into Europe this year. While the numbers heading for Italy from Libya pale in comparison, IOM says they are growing. It says more than 18,000 migrants and refugees have arrived, an increase of more than 8,000 compared to the same period last year. It says 90% of the arrivals are from sub-Saharan Africa. None are from Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Syria said today its forces have seized another town from Islamic State, Karyatayn, in the central part of the country, a week after retaking the historic city of Palmyra. State media said the seizure of Karyatayn with support of Russian airstrikes gives the government a strategic victory, securing oil and gas routes between the Damascus area and oil fields in eastern Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused U.S. President Barack Obama of criticizing him behind his back over press freedom issues during a visit last week to Washington. Erdogan's administration has been widely criticized for violating human rights, imprisoning journalists, and taking over several media organizations in the country. After the pair met for closed-door talks on the sidelines of the White House's nuclear security summit, Obama said Friday the approach they had been taking toward the press is one that could lead Turkey down a path that would be very troubling. The U.S. leader says he raised those concerns with Erdogan, who in turn today denied they discussed the issue, saying Obama made the comments behind my back. Billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump is drawing new attention for his views on abortion, NATO, nuclear arms, and his treatment of women as his political challengers try to cut into his lead as the front-running U.S. Republican Party presidential candidate. Political analysts are suggesting his unexpected surge to the nomination has been slowed as Republicans and others begin to question his views and say that his chances are bleak of winning November's election. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
When I went to a radio station that is in the traditional stronghold, I was attacked and beaten like a small boy inside a radio station.
The Zambian President Edgar Lungu calls for peace ahead of the August 11 general election.
The police, as you see, they have blocked us, they have shoved us, they will not allow us to talk, they will not allow us to do our job.
Demonstrators in Cameroon defy the police to protest against moves to enable long-time President Paul Biya to seek re-election.
Continuez à travailler. Nous allons rendre public nos résultats de cette nuit, cette semaine matin. Et puis,
he says we continue to work and we will publish our result today or tomorrow.
And human rights groups denounce a wave of opposition arrests in the Republic of Congo. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has called for peace ahead of the August 11 general election following concerns of inter-party violence ahead of the vote. Frank Bwalya, deputy spokesman for the ruling Patriotic Front Party, told me President Lungu's call followed a recent meeting with opposition leaders organized by Catholic bishops to ensure the election is devoid of violence.
This latest call by the president is something that many, many Zambians may not have paid attention to for a simple reason, that this has always been President Lungu's message. So the disposition of our president has been a non-violence disposition, even on a personal level. He's a very peaceful man, and we do know that the president is agonizing a lot to see a new trend in our country where political violence is escalating. Zambians will remember that I'm the latest victim of such intolerance and violence. When I went to a radio station that is in the traditional stronghold of the opposition political party in Zambia called the United Party for National Development, UPND, I was attacked and beaten like a small boy inside a radio station.
There are suggestions that the party seem not to be united ahead of the election, and some people are saying that the party will lose the presidential election because some leading members of the party, including Guy Scott, who was then a former vice president and a leading member of the Patriotic Front, have decided to either defect or endorse the presidential candidate of an opposition party in the run-up to the election. What is your reaction to that?
The problem is that some of our people, in fact, not many, very few of our people, are refusing to think logically. If I have a team of 10 people, and when I won a game previously, 5 people did not support me. They tried to do everything to make me lose, but I won the game. And then these same 5 people at the next game decide to leave so that I can replace them with other people who are committed to the cause. How can somebody say the chances of me losing are higher than before? It doesn't make sense. However, propaganda sometimes thrives on that kind of illogical thinking. Dr. Guy Scott did everything in January to frustrate the efforts of PF to retain power. He was aiding the opposition. We know a lot of things that he did. If it had not been for the military, army chiefs, and other security wings, including the church, to sit him down to stop his destructive conduct, he would have gone all the way until voting day. So the departure of Mr. Guy Scott is something that has been announced now. He departed, he stopped supporting us a long time. However, some people may be fooled to think that we can lose because now this man has left. He stopped supporting President Lungu. He's supposed to support supporting our party during the last election, which we won without his support.
Well, there are suggestions that the 50% plus one of the threshold in the new constitution is unlikely to be met by any party during the presidential election on August 11. How confident are you that you'll be able to meet it, particularly when the PF was not able to make it in the presidential by-election recently that President Lungu won?
We didn't get 50% plus one in the presidential election, which was actually a by-election in January, for a simple reason, that in a by-election, Zambians usually don't turn out in big numbers to go and vote. And therefore, in our strongholds, Lusaka, Copperbelt, Wapula, Mutinga, Northern, including Eastern Province, which has also become our stronghold, very few people went to vote. The United Party for National Development, UPND, with their leader, Ms. Gainde Hichilema, performed very well because almost 80% of their people turned out to go and vote. And these people in Southern Province only vote for one candidate, one party. So they all voted for Mr. Gainde Hichilema. In some cases, Mr. Gainde Hichilema getting 15,000 and our candidate getting zero. All other candidates getting 0, 0, 0. That's what happened. So the happenings of January 2015 cannot be compared to what will happen in August 2016. And usually in Zambia, in a general election, the turnout is far higher than in a by-election. The same happened when President Mwanawasa died and President Rupia Banda stood. 2008, very, very few people turned out to go and vote. So to say PF is not going to get 50% plus one because they failed to get it in the past is illogical, because you are not looking at the valuables that were obtaining at that time. It's not the same valuables that are going to be obtaining this time around.
Frank Bwalya is the deputy spokesman for the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The opposition in Cameroon has defied police and continued protests against efforts by the ruling party to organize early elections. The opposition says Cameroon's 84-year-old president, Paul Biya, is angling to be president for life after 34 years already in office. Several protesters have been wounded or arrested since demonstrations started last Tuesday. Protesters have been urged to dress in Black Sunday. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Kawala, opposition leader of the Cameroon People's Party, CPP, says they are dressed in black as a symbol of sadness over President Paul Biya's long stay in power and persistent brutality against voices opposing his attempt to be president for life. She says dozens of protesters have been arrested or wounded by heavily armed police in several towns, including Cameroon's capital Yaoundé and the economic capital Douala, during the protests.
The police, as you see, they have blocked us, they have shoved us, they will not allow us to talk, they will not allow us to do our job as the political leaders of this country. They have stepped on the rights of citizens.
Kawala, who is a member of a coalition of four opposition political parties, says they will continue the demonstrations until President Paul Biya says no to calls by his ruling party for him to change the constitution and organize early elections. Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma Bakari says the protests are illegal and will not be allowed to take place.
The fact that you are a politician does not allow you to take the law into your own hand. When you violate the law in such circumstances, the consequences are very well known. What they wanted to have, they had it.
Biya revised the constitution in 2008 to remove presidential term limits. His current mandate ends in 2018. The opposition parties are afraid Biya wants to surprise them by changing the constitution yet again. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Several Several human rights organizations have denounced a wave of opposition arrests in the Republic of Congo. Tensions remain high in the country following the recent re-election of incumbent President Denis Sassou Nguesso, as the opposition has contested the result and called on the Congolese people for civil disobedience. For VOA, Emily Iob has more from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan.
Amnesty International, as well as several Congolese human rights organizations, say the recent arrests of political opponents were arbitrary and they have called on Congolese authorities to release them.
Nous demandons aux acteurs politiques de résoudre les contentieux politiques.
Christian Munzeo, president of the Engagement for Peace and Human Rights Organization, says the group is asking politicians to resolve their political disagreements by political means and not through violence, curtailing freedom and arbitrary arrests. The arrest followed the announcement last week of the re-election of incumbent president Denis Sassou Nguesso with about 60% of the vote in a controversial first-round poll, extending his more than 30-year rule in the Central African nation. The opposition claims the election was rigged and has denounced the crackdown.
DGST ne peut pas se permettre de débarquer chez quelqu'un à 5 heures du matin.
Coordinator of the opposition coalition, IDC Frosad, Charles Zachary Boao, says the secret police can't come in somebody's home in the middle of the night, arrest him in front of his family, and take him to an unknown place, and then claim this is the rule of law. Congolese government spokesperson Thierry Mungala told VOA that the alleged wave of arrest was more of a wavelet, since it only concerned two people who have been accused of compromising national security. Mungala also said civil disobedience is not in the Congolese constitution, is therefore illegal, and should be treated as such. The poll and the announcement of the result occurred during a media blackout to prevent the opposition from releasing illegal results, according to the government. But Boao says they still intend to do just that.
Continuer à travailler. Nous allons rendre public nos résultats, si ce n'est pas cette nuit, c'est demain matin.
He says, we continue to work and we will publish our result today or tomorrow, and we will carry on civil resistance until the real results are accepted. Boao adds that some candidates are preparing to appeal the election results. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
Kenya marks the one-year anniversary of the brutal Al-Shabaab attacks on Nairobi's Garissa University that killed 144 people, most of them students. Families of the victims held a memorial service in Nairobi Saturday. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from the capital, Nairobi.
In central Nairobi, a handful of parents met in a public park to remember the victims of the Garissa University attack. The parents lit candles and one after the other stood to talk about their loss and to give words of encouragement to help others overcome their loss. In April 2015, a group of armed men from the militant group Al-Shabaab stormed the university before sunrise and started killing the students. Al-Shabaab militants said they attacked the campus in retaliation for Kenyan military operations in Somalia. The siege at Garissa went on for at least 12 hours. Kenyan security forces were severely criticized for their slow response. According to local media, it took them at least 7 hours to reach the university. Samuel Ojoro is one of the organizers of the memorial service.
So we have gathered here today to commemorate the first anniversary since that brutal murder of our children. Yesterday, we spent day long in the office of the president, talking to relevant authorities. So we held brief with the principal administrative secretary, Mr. Kihara, who we entrusted with our message to take to State House.
Agnes Waweru lost her daughter in the attack last year. She spoke of her pain.
Nakumbuka hiyo tarehe mbili kwa huzuni mwingi.
I remember this day with a lot of pain. It reminds me how I lost my daughter. She was a hard-working girl, and everyone liked her. She wanted to continue with her studies so that she can live a good life. Another parent who traveled from Garissa County, 370 kilometers from Nairobi, spoke of his frustration in search of compensation.
Kama sisi tutapewa kiasi hata kama ni kiasi gani ya compensation.
We want to be compensated, this parent says. No matter how little it is, we don't want to be coming back here every time. Parents are crying when they keep calling us back. They're reminding us of our children. We are requesting the government to compensate us. We don't want to be coming back to Nairobi. In the meeting, organizers and group leaders, like Chairman Janai Njenga, had a tough time dissuading some parents about requesting an audience with the president and demanding compensation for their loss. Njenga says there are people taking advantage of their loss to advance their own agenda.
Na katika support kutoka kwa government kufikia saa hizi, hatujapata habari yoyote.
Njenga says we have not received any support from the government. People are organizing on their own. They do not involve the parents who lost their children. He says we are wondering where people are getting the permission to hold such meetings without the parents. For now, Garissa University victims' families continue to overcome the pain. But many feel they have been abandoned by the state and their communities, as some continue to search for answers what happened that day at the university. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A local think tank, the Zimbabwean Democracy Institute, or ZDI, has released a report indicating functionalism, not the opposition or international pressure, will ultimately lead to the demise of the ruling ZANU-PF party. ZDI Director Petsisayi Ruhanya tells VOA Zimbabwe Studio Services Blessing Zulu that with the level of infighting, ZANU-PF will lose the next elections to the opposition.
Our major argument in this report is that the greatest threat to ZANU rule is ZANU itself. The problems that are taking place within the party and lack of consensus among the top leadership, and also lack of consensus in the grassroots structures that are seen in the expulsions, suspensions, and constant infighting. The story of ZANU is the story of the day, every day in Zimbabwe. We think that the weakening of the party internally will ultimately see the demise of ZANU at the national level. So ZANU is a threat to itself because of internal discohesion and authoritarian erosion of the leader himself. And fundamentally, the entry into politics of First Lady Grace Mugabe has popularized the politics of defense. When she moves around the country and with the television and radio live broadcast to insult people, to attack party people, to show disrespect for party structure, party institutions, what it tells us is that there is no longer order.
But Dr. Ruhanya, your critics might say this is not the first time there's been internal fights in ZANU-PF. It goes back to the Liberation War.
But if you look at the struggles in ZANU, there was never a situation where ZANU suspended its people in the manner that they've done. Suspending 9 provincial chairpersons and suspending a sitting vice president. It has never happened in this race. All the other vice presidents were succeeded through death. They died on their own, and after dying, then they were succeeded. But the manner in which they dealt with Mujuru has no precedent in the history of post-independent Zimbabwe. And if you look at the people that are following Mujuru, there has never been an opposition political party that moved out of ZANU and that had the following of uncontested liberation nationalists like Mutambara and others who are following Mujuru.
Petsisayi Ruhanya is the director of the Zimbabwean Democracy Institute. He spoke with VOA Studio Services' Blessing Zulu from the capital, Harare. A U.S. company with operations in Kenya, Burn Manufacturing, is helping improve the lives of thousands of East Africans with an efficient charcoal-burning cook stove. The so-called saving stove, known as Jikokoa in Swahili, consumes less than half the charcoal of its competitors. It's also healthier. The stove is also creating jobs and helping to conserve natural forests. Boston Naya is the general manager of Burn Manufacturing in Kenya. Reporter Ruben Kiyama asked him when and how the company got into the cook stove industry.
Our founder, Peter Scott, has been working on clean cook stoves for about 17 to 20 years in sub-Saharan Africa. And Burn was founded in 2011. but we only started manufacturing in Kenya in August 2013. And so we spent 2 years raising money, developing the product, developing a team. And so we've only been manufacturing in Kenya for about 2.5 years.
How did your company get interested in making stars for Africa?
Again, it was back to Peter Scott, our founder. And the reason why he was interested in clean burning cook stoves in Africa was the pressure on the forests in Africa. The population is booming and cities are developing quickly, but there isn't a big growth in cooking technologies. And there isn't a huge growth in, say, gas, LPG. There's more people in the cities, and at the same time, the forests are going the other way. That's why we did it from a high level. But again, if you look at a household in Kenya or East Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, especially in an urban setting, you might be spending 30% or 50% of your income on charcoal for cooking, for example. So you can look at it, it's you talk about poverty, but one of the reasons why people can't, you know, continue to improve their livelihoods is because they're spending all their money on fuel for cooking. So not only you have forests from the global perspective, but you have people's pocket, and at the household level, you can have a big impact.
There have been many types of cook stoves introduced into Africa in recent years. What makes this particular one different?
So the difference with the GCocoa is that it's almost designed by consumers. So many products are designed in Europe or designed in the US in a lab, and then somebody just makes it in China and sends it to Kenya. We have the exact opposite approach, where we design everything in Kenya with Kenyan women and Kenyan households so that it meets exactly their needs. And then we manufacture it right here. And so instead of having our design or product development in the Western world somewhere and then made in China, and then just send it to Kenya like everybody's supposed to like it here, we center everything right here to make sure we get it right. So our products are, not only do they save fuel, but they also save you time, and they're more usable.
In Kenya, where has it been tested, and what have been the results?
We have more than 140,000 customers in Kenya, and we have customers in every single county in Kenya, even Isiolo or whichever county, wherever. And so it's been tested all over the country, mostly in urban settings. And people are saving 60% of the fuel, which means 60% of the money they were spending on charcoal for cooking.
How much does the cook stove cost, and where can one buy?
Right now, the cook stove costs $3,800. You can buy it at any of the major supermarkets, Nivus, Tuskies, Nakumat. You can also buy from M-Copa, or you can go to your local SACO and ask them if you can purchase through their SACO.
BAM, your company, is the first cook stove company in the world to receive investment from Acumen Fund, General Electric, and the U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Why?
The reason why we're the first company to be invested in by General Electric, U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and Acumen Fund is because we're the first company that's achieving scale. And the reason why we're achieving scale is because Kenyan consumers love our products. And it's because you're saving money and you have an easier lifestyle. Other products, maybe it's a good idea, but in reality, consumers aren't buying those products because they don't meet their needs. So it's all the response of the market.
From here, what are your next steps?
So we have a wood-burning GCO coming on later this year that'll be available to the rural communities in Kenya and East Africa. And then we're expanding to the other countries in East Africa, namely Uganda and Tanzania, significantly this year. And then we're looking at West Africa to start a new manufacturing hub and service all of ECOWAS.
Do you have any message to investors in Africa, to customers in other parts of the region?
Yeah, so I think my main message would be to customers in Sub-Saharan Africa. If you're using a lot of money on fuel for cooking, that doesn't need to be your life, and it doesn't need to be your life forever. There's a better solution, so look out for our product, try it. If you like it, please let us know and let your friends and family know. And if it isn't available in your country yet, please contact us and let us know that you're interested, and we'll see what we can do.
Boston Naya is the Kenyan-based general manager of Burn Manufacturing. He spoke with reporter Ruben Chiama in Nairobi. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In tennis, Victoria Azarenka secured back-to-back WTA titles with a straight set victory over Svetlana Kuznetsova in the Miami Open final. The Belarusian won 6-3, 6-2 in 77 minutes to add a third Miami title to her victories in 2009 and 2011. The 26-year-old, who won in Indian Wells 2 weeks ago, will return to the world's top five next week. Russian Kuznetsova was bidding for her second title of the year after her victory in Sydney in January. Azarenka becomes just the third woman to achieve the Indian Wells Miami double after Steph Graf in 1994 and 1996 and Kim Clijsters in 2005. In the men's event, Novak Djokovic will play Kel Nishikori later Sunday after both went through in straight sets. Serbia's Djokovic, the five-time champion and world number one, beat Belgian David Goffin at 7-6, 7-5, 6-4. Japanese sixth seed Nishikori beat Australian Nick Kyrgios at 6-3, 7-5 in the evening session. Djokovic will try to match Andre Agassi's record haul of six Miami titles and become the first man to win the Indian Wells Miami double 3 years in a row. Turning to football, Amnesty International has published its fifth report detailing the experiences and abuse of migrant workers constructing venues for the 2022 World Cup. The 80-page report, The Ugly Side of the Beautiful Game, is based on the testimony of 234 male migrants provided between February 2015 and January this year. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell has more.
Based on interviews with over 130 migrant construction workers building the Khalifa Stadium, most from Bangladesh, India and Nepal, they allege widespread abuses, including squalid accommodation and working conditions which amount to forced labour under international law. The interviews are voiced by actors.
The salary is $200 per month. It is not enough to cover my living expenses, my debt for the recruiter fee, and to send money home for my family.
Many workers say they had to pay large fees of up to $4,300 to recruiters in their home country. All but six said the salary was less than promised, in some cases by half, and sometimes they weren't paid at all. If the workers complained, they said they were threatened with deportation or withheld pay.
If I lose this job, they will throw me out of the country, but I will still have a huge debt to pay.
Amnesty says conditions have improved in the past year, but singles out Qatar's so-called kafala employment system as the main problem.
The system gives employers excessive control over their employees. In particular, they have the power to deny the workers the ability to leave the country or change job.
Qatar insists it is working to improve conditions for migrant workers, such as introducing a wage protection system. But Amnesty says it is not doing enough and wants football's world governing body, FIFA, to speak out.
In reality, we've seen very little concrete action, and by that we mean consistent, strong public support for reform in Qatar and genuine investigations into the conditions of workers on World Cup stadiums.
FIFA insists it takes human rights seriously and is working alongside Qatari authorities to improve conditions. Currently, around 5,000 migrants are working on World Cup projects, a number set to soar to 36,000 in the next 2 years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In athletics, Kenya's Viola Jechumba shaved almost 4 minutes off her personal best when taking victory at the Sportsimo Prague half marathon on Sunday. The 26-year-old came home in 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 51 seconds, the fourth fastest time in history on a record-eligible course. On what was a calm, cool day in the Czech capital, the men's race was won in equally convincing fashion by Daniel Wanjiru, the Kenyan overcoming a mid-race fall to take victory in 59 minutes and 20 seconds in a race where the top five athletes finished within 60 minutes. But it was the unheralded Chechumba who stole the show with her breakthrough performance. The 26-year-old came into the race as an outsider, holding a best of just 1 hour, 9 minutes and 29 seconds, but she had announced herself as a potential star when taking victory over several established Kenyan internationals at the Discovery Cross Country in Eldoret back in January. Finally, on a sad note, an Ethiopian marathon runner died and five others got serious injuries after their training group was hit by a truck while out running in Sululuta, just north of Addis Ababa on Saturday. 25-year-old Ashgray Gima died at the scene, and his teammates Damtiu Tilahun, Tamrat Wuku, Teshoma Hailu, and Ashber are all recovering from serious injuries. Many Ethiopian runners train on main roads, and the runners have limited access to health care. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Me love no Shaba. Shaba. You say make a way, girl, I go wait. So whenever you're ready, just let me know, no. You say make a way, for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no. Ooh, what a wine, you got it, baby. Get fine for your love. And I feel to bag down for your love. The kind of love me get for you, no be joke. Can you don't carry me go. Anywhere you enter, can you scatter? You make a man spray you in dollar. Every day I won't see that your face, I can't do it at you say. I won't see that your face, again, no. I can't do it at you say. You say make a wait, girl, I will wait. Whenever you're ready, just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no. Ooh, what a wine, you got it, baby.
Sexy like my on the floor. Oh yeah, shaggy di bobo. When I see you, oh boy, I confuse so. Confuse. I say wait till you ask, I don't go refuse so. I don't go refuse. And I go DJ for you whenever you're down. I say for you, them girls they go bow, they go get a story all over the town. Your papa they beg, I go build a house.
You say make a wait, girl, I go wait. You are ready, just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no. Ooh, what a wine, you got it, baby. Girl, I go wait.
Girl, I go wait. Oh.
So whenever you are ready, just let me know, no.
Yeah.
You say make a wait for your love, I go wait.
Girl, I go wait. Oh.
So when you're ready, just let me know, no.
Yeah.
Rain on the mix. Rain on the mix. Girl, your body, girl's fire. Girl, you give me the fire. Girl, your body. bazali ya baba anya kal stasa ha kasatal samakal ekotsere o sawana na ke tlobetsa mawaza ke kono ba le botha batlala
you must become my lady oh yeah you drive me crazy yeah I can't explain this feeling
Masuedo,
baby.
Masuedo, baby. The color of my lover. The way you shaking your hips, baby girl, you give me fire. Girl, your body gets fire. Girl, you give me the fire. Girl, your body gets fire. The color of my lover. The way you shaking your hips, baby girl, you give me fire. Girl, your body gets fire.
I love you. Yeah, when you know day, I dey miss you. Yeah, when you know day, I could be your mother when you need me. Yeah, when you know day, I dey need you. Yeah, when you know day, I say wait, you must become my lady. Oh yeah, you drive me crazy. Yeah, I can't explain this feeling.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, South Africa's highest court, the Constitutional Court, delivered a judgment that will certainly strengthen democracy in the country. Regrettably, the importance of that decision was clouded by the political debate that followed the decision. Accordingly, it will be necessary to separate the legal from the political. Foremost, it must be affirmed that the courts in South Africa are independent and not subject to political control. That is very good. Secondly, in delivering its judgments, the Constitutional Court established a new case law, or what lawyers will call established law. It ruled that decision of the public protector, an anti-corruption entity, are binding. Prior to the court's decision, President Jacob Zuma and the majority of ANC in Parliament had argued that the decision of the public protector, a recommendation that could be disregarded. It was that reasoning that the court said was inconsistent with the Constitution. The political aspect of the matter is far more complicated. But let us look at what was the remedy given by the High Court. The court decided not that Jacob Zuma should step down or be impeached. It called on Jacob Zuma to comply with the report of the public protector, which means that Jacob Zuma must pay out of his pocket the excess cost for the refurbishment of his home, rural home in Natal. For this purpose, the court called on the National Treasury within 60 days to calculate the amounts that Jacob Zuma, the president, should pay out of his pocket. Now the opposition party maybe jumped the gun. They should have waited whether or not Jacob Zuma would comply. Now on Friday, Jacob Zuma said that he would repay the cost to be estimated by the Treasury and apologize to the people of South Africa for causing so much problem. Obviously, whenever the Treasury comes out with this figure, there will be political arguments. Originally, it has been established that the cost for the refurbishment was $23 million, and Jacob Zuma would have to pay part of that cost. We have to wait and see. Now, we are all aware that the goal of the opposition is to get Jacob Zuma to step down from office, and if possible, to create a division within the ANC. But this is not what the court called for. Although politically, they can make the case. And there is also coming local elections in South Africa, and they may wish to benefit from that by continuing debate. But what necessary to know is it is not unusual for constitutional courts to rule against a sitting government. It has been done many times in Europe. And in the United States, currently, the Supreme Court has on its docket a number of cases referring to President Obama's executive action. The court may well rule against the president, but that does not mean the president should vacate the office. No doubt, the decision of the court was a major blow to President Jacob Zuma and the ANC. But this should be dealt with in its proper perspective by the people of South Africa when they go to the polls, either in the local election or the next election. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a nation is never exalted by disunity. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When leaders of the world's eight top industrial countries, also known as G8, met in L'Aquila, Italy in 2009, the global economic recession and escalating food prices had pushed over a billion people into food insecurity. In short, over one in six people went to bed hungry most nights. Determined to do something about the problem, President Barack Obama announced Feed the Future, a U.S. government interagency initiative to fight global hunger in 19 countries, largely through focusing on smallholder farmers, particularly women. So we can better understand what works and what doesn't, right from the beginning, the performance and impact of individual Feed the Future programs were evaluated and the results collected by the Peace Corps, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which leads the initiative. In mid-March, little more than 5 years after Feed the Future was launched, the collected information was synthesized and issued as a report. So what is the best way to eliminate hunger? According to the report's findings, when it comes to development, people and relationships matter most. When our development programs leveraged strong community relationships and trusted and transparent community-based organizations, they were better able to achieve their objectives, such as building resilience, expanding markets, closing gender gaps, and lifting vulnerable people out of poverty, wrote Emily Hoag and Zachary Beckett in a recent blog post. Both are involved with Feed the Future. It is also worth noting that successful programs within Feed the Future shared some elements. Today we know that large-scale impact necessitates a long-term effort. Successful programs invest in research and development and promote coordination among partners. And crucially, projects that integrate quality training as part of their activities with the community can lead not only to successful change, but also lasting change. Through Feed the Future, we are reducing poverty and malnutrition around the world, and we are learning from these accomplishments. Feed the Future, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith, is a powerful example of what we can achieve when the world comes together around a shared global challenge, working with countries that want to take ownership of, contribute to, and be accountable for improving their food security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.